the Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. What a great hour we have for you here tonight. As you know, one of our favorite people, a great friend of ours, is Mr. Nick Redfern. He is originally from England. He lives now in Texas, and he is a prolific researcher and writer. He has written books that, they're all quickly becoming classics. Books like Three Men Seeking Monsters, or Strange Secrets, Real Government Files on the Unknown, or Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story, or The FBI Files, Their Top UFO Secrets Exposed, etc., etc. It goes on and on. As you can easily see, he digs into UFOs, conspiracies, cryptids, and he is a contributor to a new book published by Timothy Green Beckley's company. It's a fascinating book called Hounds of the Baskervilles, From Demon Dogs to Sherlock Holmes, The True Story of the Beast. Nick's website is nickredfern.com. Hey, Nick, welcome back to Speaking of Strange.
Hey, Josh, how's it going?
Oh, it's been a wonderful year. So much stuff is going on. You know, this year I've been working on a new TV series, a new movie. I've traveled a lot. I bet you've been having a great, crazy year also, huh?
Kind of. Actually, this year for me has been a lot of writing. For me, it sort of goes in waves where I'm sort of on the road a lot, lecturing and conferences and doing research. And then particularly when the research is done, then, you know, the sort of just hunkering down and writing the next book sort of takes priority. And that's what the last few months have been, just sort of blitzing to get the next book out and completed. You know what it's like.
I'm
ready to do a bit more traveling around a bit now. So.
Well, your career has just evolved in the most interesting ways. I mean, kind of tell us a little bit about your perception of how your career as a writer has evolved subject by subject and where it has brought you to right now.
Well, I mean, I sort of began as a writer. Actually, when I was like 18, I worked on an English magazine called Zero for about 2 years, and that was everything from sort of music, fashion, entertainment, and it was sort of primarily aimed at teenagers, and I did that for a couple of years. That's what got me into writing, but I'd had an interest in the paranormal for years. When I was a kid, growing up in England, my mom and dad took me for a week's holiday to Scotland when I was about 5 or 6, and of course, if you're going to go to Scotland, you've got to go to Loch Ness, and so we had a day at Loch Ness, and I still have sort of a few fragmentary memories of my dad telling me this story of the Loch Ness Monster, and so that really got me interested in, you know, paranormal phenomena and strange creatures and things like this, and which, you know, as I got older, I began reading books on the subject. And then when I'd done a couple of years on this Zero magazine, I thought, well, you know, why not try and combine the two, you know, the interest in the paranormal and the writing, and that's what I did, you know, and I still do a lot of sort of regular freelance writing for newspapers and magazines and all sorts of subjects, nothing to do with the paranormal, but, you know, obviously, I guess, in terms of, you know, the thing I'm sort of more known for, I suppose, is the paranormal. But I've never sort of really considered myself to be like a cryptozoologist or a ufologist. I'm more just someone who has a wide range of interest in different aspects of the paranormal or the conspiratorial or the supernatural, and I'll dig into them. And sometimes, you know, I might do a UFO book, which is followed by a Bigfoot book, followed by a Men in Black book, you know, and I like to kind of, you know, chop and change from one subject to the other and try and keep fresh that way, I think so.
You know, I've always thought, just based on my own experience, that if you begin investigating the paranormal, it doesn't matter if you start with ghosts
or UFOs or cryptids or whatever. Eventually, if you stick with it long enough and you're serious enough, you begin to realize that it all sort of connects at some level. It reminds me of that quote by Charles Fort, you can measure a circle beginning anywhere.
Yeah, and that's true.
Yeah. So what have you come to conclude about that connection between all these things?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, when I was a kid and certainly a teenager and certainly my early 20s, I would say, you know, I was more along the lines that UFOs were just nuts and bolts spacecraft and things like Bigfoot were just unknown apes running around the woods or whatever, you know, that science hadn't classified yet. But the more I've dug into it, the more I think a lot of these phenomena are interlinked somehow. You know, we often get crossovers, you know, where one paranormal phenomenon will appear at the same place and the same time even as another one. And, of course, you know, the ufologists don't like that and the cryptozoologists don't like it either, you know. So often it remains underreported unless you're kind of somebody like me and you, I think, where we realize there's more going on and we do look into it. And I've come round, I'd probably say certainly in the last 15 years or so, more to the idea that perhaps we're dealing with sort of the things that John Keel spoke about, sort of window areas and portals, to the idea that perhaps all these different phenomena kind of coexist with us and interact with us that way. And, you know, possibly they have an understanding of things like portals and doorways to our realm of existence. And that's why, number one, they're so elusive because, you know, they're actually not here all the time. And number two, why they seem to proliferate in certain areas and they're all there together. You know, it's like Point Pleasant. You had Mothman, the Men in Black, paranormal phenomena. So I think, you know, these phenomena probably originate in, you know, realms that cross paths with ours, or they have an ability to cross paths with ours, and, you know, they're all part of a bigger mystery, I think.
You know, one thing that I have found by traveling around is that some cultures are much more open to discussing the paranormal than others. Some cultures just absolutely are very uncomfortable about it, and they're very tight-lipped, and you have to work on them for a long time if you want a witness to open up. But one of the most open areas is around the UK, around the area that you are from. Especially some of the best stories about demon dogs, black dogs, and these cryptozoological anomalies. Why do you think that is, culturally speaking?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that Britain, you know, collectively, England, Scotland, Wales, you know, I think the important thing to remember is it's an island, you know, and island locations have an identity that, you know, all countries have their own identity, but when you're an island nation, I think it becomes even more so. And I think also there hasn't, although obviously, you know, Britain is advanced as any advanced nation, you know, in terms of cars, internet, you know, the whole thing. But I think what's happened is that Britain seems to have retained that sort of old world angle as well. It hasn't been obliterated, you know, by the modern era. So in other words, you know, you can go from a big built up modern city and travel 5 miles and find an 800-year-old castle, you know, which has ghost legends attached to it. Or, you know, you can go from one particular city and, you know, drive an hour and you can be in Shakespeare's birthplace, you know, and which hasn't changed. So I think, and where you have that old culture and that old aspect, the old mythologies and the old legends survive as well. And people, you know them, they remember them, they understand them, they've been told about them. And it actually doesn't take long, you know, when weird stuff happens, for that sort of modern era mindset to suddenly swing back to the idea that, wow, you know, there's weird things roaming around the woods or whatever. And I think that's why the sort of mythology and folklore have been retained so much, I think.
Earlier this year, I went to Transylvania in Romania.
Oh, cool.
And I had a great time, spent a couple of weeks just investigating castles. And on my way back, I spent some time in London, and it was the first time I'd been to London.
Okay.
And I realized that, you know, you could talk about ghosts and stuff there, and nobody acted like it was extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, they just sort of take it for granted as a part of the regular culture there.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can go pretty much any town, village in the country, and certainly every city, and, you know, there's some sort of ghostly legend attached, you know, to the old manor house or the mansion on the hill or the old castle, you know, or even the old pub, you know.
Yeah.
Not, the you know, with the old pubs, it's not just a case that the spirits are the ones you drink there. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's the other sort as well. And this is something that, you know, everybody's sort of brought up with. And it's not perceived as being weird. It's just part of, you know, a traditional culture that, you know, you sort of embrace legends of ghosts, you know, the headless nun or whatever, you know, or the Loch Ness Monster, or the, you know, these big cats running around, that kind of thing. You know, there's so many different strange phenomena that it actually doesn't become strange. You know what I mean?
Sure. We have a couple minutes before our first break, so we don't want to get too deep in this, but tell us first a little bit about this book in general, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about your contribution. But what is this book, The Hound of the Baskervilles, about?
Okay, well, the actual title of this book is Hounds of the Baskervilles, but it obviously pays homage to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's book, The Hound of the Baskervilles. Now, a lot of people don't realize that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle actually based his novel of this sort of blazing-eyed, huge black dog that roamed the moors of Devonshire. A lot of people don't realize he based his novel on existing legends and mythologies of these phantom black dogs in England. So basically, this new book from Tim Beckley, it reproduces the original Holmes novel, The Hound of the Baskervilles, but it has various papers from different people, including me, who are demonstrating the reality that provoked the famous novel, and how Conan Doyle, in my paper, I pointed how he was inspired by certain real-life characters, you know, that actually became sort of semi-altered, you know, for the novel. It wasn't just the black dog itself, it was actually real people as well. And so it's a case of sort of peeling back the layers of fiction to uncover even more intriguing and astonishing factual issue, but one of sort of paranormal proportions, if you like.
Yeah. In fact, of course, years ago, I wrote a book about non-human apparitions, and the publisher decided to call it Pet Ghosts, and I always point out that I wasn't quite satisfied with that title because it's about a lot more than just cats and dogs. And even in that book, however, you contributed an experience that you and your wife had after one of your dogs died. And when we come back from the break, we'll talk more about your contribution to this particular new book. But also, it's my understanding that you had a personal experience with something beastly that might have come into your bedroom.
About 10 years ago, and it's kind of related to this whole black dog phenomenon as well.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll dig into that when we come back. I'm talking this hour with Nick Redfern, and he's written a ton of different books not too long ago. He published a book about Men in Black, and I was delighted and flattered that he included some of my thoughts on the Men in Black. All his stuff is good quality material, and you can learn more about him at nickredfern.com. This new book from Inner Light Global Communications is called Hounds of the Baskervilles. I guess it's Hounds of the Baskervilles. From Demon Dogs to Sherlock Holmes, the true story of the beast. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.
Werewolves of London. Ah, ooh.
program where the unusual becomes usual. Keeping you company tonight. Thanks for spending your evening with us. It's called Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, talking this hour with Nick Redfern, a prolific author on all things strange. And the newest contribution he has out is to a book called Hounds of the Baskervilles, From Demon Dogs to Sherlock Holmes, The True Story of the Beast. His website is nickredfern.com. We'll also have a link up there to this book on Amazon.com, and also some coverage this book has gotten in the media. Before we talk more about your specific contribution and some of your experiences, Nick, you know, one thing that I thought was really weird when I was digging into this subject is if you take the idea of, say, hellhounds and black dogs, they look familiar enough that people are able to immediately recognize them as being canines, and yet clearly they are not canines in the normal way we understand that term, because they have special powers. Sometimes they radiate this strange heat. They're very, very powerful. They're aggressive. They pop out of nowhere and they disappear. It's almost like they have just enough in common with this realm that we think maybe they evolved in a similar fashion, but they're just removed enough that they evolved with some very extraordinary characteristics that we don't find in this realm. Do you get a sense that maybe they kind of flit in and out, and they're in this strange border area between realms?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I don't dispute that at all. I think, actually, that's sort of right on target, Josh. I mean, you're quite right. These things do look like dogs, or they look canine, at least. One of the things I would point out for people who may not be sort of fully aware of the phenomenon, you know, the black dogs are generally, well, they're called phantom black dogs because they look like huge black dogs. But we're talking about sometimes animals that are kind of like the size of a small pony. You know, we're not talking about something the size of average Labrador or something like that. These are sort of very large, menacing, muscular black hounds that people have sometimes said it's difficult to sort of define what sort of breed, you know, but they just look like a very large canine animal, sort of muzzle, pointed ears, large muscular limbs, long tail, glossy coat, but just completely and utterly black, apart from their eyes, which are sort of blazing bright red, kind of like self-illuminated laser light almost, is probably a good way to describe it. And they very often haunt, which is a good term to use, very often haunt the same places over and over again, like, for example, ancient crossroads, ancient bridges, cemeteries. And these are all sort of the locations that are inextricably tied with paranormal phenomena, old crossroads, you know, bridges, cemeteries, etc. And there are a number of theories that exist around these creatures. One is that they're sort of like a portent to death. Another one is that they act as like a grim reaper, you know, to sort of come and collect someone. You know, if you see the black dog, it means, you know, your death of either you or someone is sort of very nearby. Or occasionally they act as a protector, which is kind of odd, but there are some reports where the black dogs have been helpful. But what's interesting is when you talk about them flitting in and out of our reality, we do get that a lot. You know, it's like they suddenly appear and they vanish. And they often vanish when people go to touch them. And the reason sometimes people go to touch them is that because they think that although they look a bit intimidating, they're just a huge dog. And they try and want to demonstrate that they're friendly so they don't get attacked. But the minute they touch it, it's like the dog vanishes. And there are also reports of people sort of touching it with a piece of iron and it explodes in like a flash of light. So I think there's a clear indication, because they're always seen, you know, sort of faithfully patrolling their same areas over and over again, that, again, we could be dealing with, like, portals and doorways, and, you know, maybe their portal is, you know, somehow inextricably sort of connected with the afterlife, possibly.
So what was the angle you took in your contribution to this new book?
Well, it's basically two things, Josh. One was to demonstrate to people how, why, and under what circumstances Sir Arthur Conan Doyle basically use these stories as inspiration for the Hounds of the Baskervilles. excuse me, the Hound of the Baskervilles. And the other one, the other angle I took was to demonstrate the history of these black dogs in Britain, to show people how there really was, you know, and still is actually, a phenomenon of these huge black hounds that, you know, was so deeply ingrained in the populace centuries ago that, you know, it's had a lasting effect, not just on people to this day, but on, you know, one of the most famous fictional detective series as well. So.
And as a part of this, you talked about your own experience, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I should sort of, you know, begin this with first is a lot of people, well, not a lot, sorry, but some cases, the black dogs have reportedly sort of reared up onto their hind legs. So they kind of almost look in that stance like a werewolf. You know, it's like most dogs, if you teach them, you know, they can briefly sort of stand on their hind legs and sort of totter around while you tease them with a cookie or whatever, you know what I mean? You can train dogs to do that, but it's not their natural stance, obviously. But with these black dogs, it's almost like they can alter their leg positions, you know, and they can literally walk as easy on four legs as on two. And I think everybody at some point in their life, maybe on many occasions, certainly this has happened to me on a couple of occasions, you've had a dream, a very weird dream, that doesn't seem like a normal dream. It's one, you know, you consistently remember for your entire life because something profoundly strange happened in it. Or, you know, it was so real that it just didn't seem like a fragmentary memory of the day's events. And I had one of these experiences in 2002, and it was probably, you know, early hours of the morning, 2, 3 a.m., and I had one of those classic conditions of so-called sleep paralysis, you know, where you're semi-awake and you're in almost like a dreamlike state, but you're not really fully awake, you're not fully asleep, but it's sort of like a real effort to either fall asleep or wake up. You know, you're in this sort of liminal zone where you're neither here nor there, really. And it's very often in this particular state, which I don't believe it's psychological. I think the dream state can actually open us up to other realms of existence that are almost like Matrix-like. You know, it's almost like a living reality, but in a dream-like situation. I really do believe, you know, there are dimensions, if you like, or realms that kind of act on those principles. And so I was in this, you know, dreamlike sleep paralysis state and had this ominous feeling that there was this large sort of canine-type creature. At the time, I was living in a duplex, so all the rooms were off this one long corridor that, you know, that ran down the middle of the house. And, you know, the neighbors on the other side there was the exact opposite layout. So I had this nightmare, if you like, of this tall canine-type creature coming slowly down the corridor. It was sort of cloaked, and it had this hood and like a large werewolf or large dog-type face. And I had a feeling, or I can still remember hearing it to this day, like a very fast growl, but it was not just a random growl. It's difficult to explain how or why I could say this, because I don't really know. But it was like I knew it was a language, even though I couldn't understand it. It was like a growl, fast language, and the animal or creature was very, you know, angry or hostile about something. And it took all my sort of effort to wake up, at which point this thing sort of dissipated into nothing. And I had this feeling of it sort of racing out of the bedroom, back up the corridor, and then just vanishing. And, you know, this was 10 years ago, thereabouts now, maybe a little bit longer. And I've never forgotten the very vivid details. And it was so vivid that, you know, not only did it sort of stay in my mind all this time, you know, it also, interestingly enough, has a bearing on a lot of the stuff I've done since, you know, with research in black dogs and werewolves. So it was almost, you know, a precursor to what was going to come in reality. But it truthfully didn't feel, you know, like your average nightmare or something after watching too many horror films. You know, it was far, far different to that.
Well, you know, in fact, I have heard that when people have these kinds of experiences, there is an old wives' tale, if you will, that one should wait at least a year and a day before telling anyone about the experience. Of course, you know, you said this happened to you 10 years ago, but I'm sure you've heard this legend as well, huh?
You know, I've actually not heard that part of it. I know I certainly told people in less than a year, but...
Uh-oh.
Exactly.
Seems like you've done okay since then, though, right?
Yeah, things haven't been too bad. But, I mean, yeah, joking aside, you know, a lot of people, certainly in the past, they really viewed encounters with these black dogs, you know, it was almost like a curse had been put on someone, you know, to see one was akin to meeting the Grim Reaper, or, you know, this dark cloud was going to descend on you, your family, or your friends, and somebody was going to be, you know, taken within the next few days or weeks. I mean, that was literally how it was seen.
Sure.
You know, and it was really perceived as an ominous omen, if you like.
All right, we're going to take another break here. When we come back, we'll continue talking about these strange creatures and also what kind of connection they may have to, well, UFOs and other areas of the paranormal. I'm Joshua P. Warren, talking with Nick Redfern. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. This hour, don't forget you can go to speakingofstrange.com for a live chat during the show. Links to various news items and more information on topics discussed. Also, a link to this new book that Nick Redfern contributed to. It's published by Tim Beckley's Inner Light Global Communications. The book is called Hounds of the Baskervilles. From Demon Dogs to Sherlock Holmes, the true story of the beast. In Nick's personal website is nickredfern.com. Nick, you point out a variety of potential connections between these creatures and what we might call UFOs. Let's begin with this sighting in 1972, the story of Nigel Lee. What happened that night?
Yeah, this actually occurred at a place, Josh, called the Cannock Chase, which is a large area of forest or woodland, actually only about 5 miles from where I grew up as a child. And the Cannock Chase, you know, sort of heavily forested, very ancient. It's home to an ancient sort of hill fort that goes back about 4,000 years. You know, so ancient man lived here a long time ago, and it has a lot of traditions, folklore, mythology, and mysteries attached to it. There's been sightings of everything from UFOs, big cat encounters, ghostly black dogs, Bigfoot-type creatures, werewolves. There's a famous cemetery on the Cannock Chase deep in the woods where there have been a lot of werewolf sightings over the years. And so, you know, it's almost like Point Pleasant or somewhere like that. You know, it's just like a hotbed of weird activity. And one of the things that's sort of been prevalent there are these black dogs. Now, the case I talk about in the book from 1972, this is just one of many I mentioned from this area, involved a guy named Nigel Lee who saw late one night when he was driving home one of these classic black dogs cross the road. And he described it, you know, typically how people described them, you know, hundreds of years ago, literally with the blazing eyes, you know, the huge body, and just, you know, just basically just looming there in the middle of the road. And, of course, you know, like most people would, if you see a dog in the road, he slowed down, assuming that, you know, it would walk away or whatever, but he didn't. But what was interesting is that the manifestation of this black dog actually coincided with the almost simultaneous manifestation of this strange ball of glowing light that sort of descended out of nowhere and literally sort of crashed onto the road. It wasn't like a solid object. It sort of exploded in this cascade of light, and then suddenly in the place of the light, when, you know, his eyes became acclimatized again, that's where the huge dog was suddenly just looming there, you know. So it was almost like one of these classic ghostly balls of light, you know, like the Brown Mountain light or the Marfa lights of Texas, kind of exploded and literally transformed into something else, which, you know, possibly, if we understood the science behind it, Nigel Lee's case might offer us some indications as to what lies at both sort of the black dog mystery and certain aspects of unidentified aerial phenomena as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I have heard so many reports of people who see these balls of light, and at first they say, I thought it was a UFO, but when I got close enough, there was some type of a being inside, you know, and so it makes you wonder when they switch from dimension to dimension, if this is sort of the vehicle for that transition. But, of course, one of the places that is most associated with an extraordinary UFO event is Rendlesham Forest. Mm. And it turns out there is a connection not only between UFOs, but also black dogs there, right?
Yeah, I mean, Rendlesham Forest was without doubt, you know, the site of Britain's most famous UFO encounter in December 1980, when some sort of object manifested and was seen by numerous military personnel. Well, a lot of people don't realize is that, like the Cannock Chase, Rendlesham Forest is a hotbed of weirdness. There's been UFO activity, ghostly encounters, big black cats are seen there again. There's even a Bigfoot-type creature has been seen that's locally for centuries been known as the Shug Monkey, S-H-U-G. And that's a sort of a derived from an ancient English word, skucker, which means demon. So it's basically, it's like demon monkey, the Shug Monkey. And again, on top of that, we have black dog reports. And I talk about one from 1983, where a couple saw this huge hound, quite not sort of typified in a classic situation, because this was in daylight and it didn't have the blazing red eyes. But they basically were walking through the woods and just were confronted by this huge black dog that was just basically standing there staring at them, almost as if it anticipated that they were going to appear. And they felt there was something very ominous and weird about this dog, and also kind of like cunningly intelligent. They felt, you know, there's some deep intelligence behind its eyes, the way it was just staring at them. And they felt quite unsettled by it. And as they slowly moved forward, you know, kind of, you know, state of trepidation to get past it, the dog literally sort of blinked out in the, you know, in a wink of an eye, so to speak. It was gone. And quite not surprisingly, I guess, you know, the couple was quickly gone as well. But this sort of demonstrates two important things. One, you know, it's not just an old mystery. I mean, this was 1983. Nigel Lees was 72. You know, I have even more up-to-date reports from the 21st century as well. So that's an important factor. And the other one is, you know, the traditional thing of these dogs just being blazing-eyed animals seen at night isn't the case, you know, with the Rendlesham one, but the proportions and the description of the dog was pretty much identical. So I think, you know, there's still a great deal to be learned about these experiences.
Now, have these types of encounters occurred with any kind of regularity in the United States, or are most of them in Europe?
Well, that's actually a good point. No, we do get reports, a lot of reports from the U.S., but I think, you know, the only downside is that because the U.S. is sort of a relatively new nation in terms of, you know, historical record and the written word, etc. You know, we just don't know what was really going on, maybe in the 14th or 15th century. You know, we have a lot of reports from mainland Europe and Britain then because, you know, they were already, you know, up and running countries, so to speak. But, you know, with America just being a relatively recent nation, we just don't have that long folkloric tradition. But what I will say is that we do have reports in the U.S. from at least the last 250 years, you know, of these creatures. There's actually a road in Arizona that I passed just by accident once driving through to a conference called Devil Dog Road, which I've never actually researched, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if that wasn't connected with a local tradition of one of these animals.
And have you heard of anything recently, a sighting like this that's happened in the U.S.?
I personally haven't, but what I can say is that there's a chapter in the book from a lady named Claudia Cunningham, who's done an excellent paper on sightings of black dogs in a cemetery in Albany, New York. It's actually the cemetery where none other than Charles Fort is buried. And there have been a number of very good, credible, and very recent sightings of these black dogs roaming around the old Albany Cemetery.
Has there ever been a really good photograph taken of one of these creatures?
You know, to the best of my knowledge, there hasn't. But I think one of the reasons is because a lot of the reports, admittedly, are, you know, centuries old. And those that aren't, you know, it's like they occur at such a random situation where, you know, somebody's walking home late at night, if their car's broken down, you know, and they've got to cut through a piece of woodland. Your natural thought isn't, oh, I'll get the camera out just in case, you know. And when people do see them, it's kind of like, you know, when you witness a car accident, people don't do the things normally you would anticipate doing in advance, you know, because your logic goes out of, you know, out of normal state, the adrenaline kicks in, and you don't behave normally, you know, and I think that possibly explains why. And also, I wouldn't be at all surprised if, you know, given their nature, you know, if the camera didn't actually pick anything up, that, you know, that wouldn't surprise me either.
Sure. We have about a minute till our next break. Can you tell us more about how to find this book or anything else that people would want to read that you've written or participate?
Yeah, sure. Well, this book's called Hounds of the Baskervilles, From Demon Dogs to Sherlock Holmes, and it's edited and compiled by Tim Green-Beckley, and chapters from me, Andrew Gable, Claudia Cunningham, William Kern, and an introduction from Tim, all on the black dogs. And it also reproduces Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's classic novel, The Hound of the Baskervilles, and it's lavishly illustrated, you know, with sort of very, very old artistic and, you know, imagery of these devil dogs and of Sherlock Holmes. And it creates like a nice atmospheric old world type book, you know, the type that unfortunately we don't see many of today, but it sort of really takes us back, you know, to the Victorian era and foggy moors and ghastly beasts running around, etc.
Sure. Ironically, my wife just recently read The Hound of the Baskervilles and just loved it. So
cool.
It's great that it's reproduced there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will ask Nick Redfern, now that you have heard this interview, the way synchronicity works out, if you happen to see one of these black dogs, what does it mean? What should you do? Should you be afraid? Should you view it as something positive? We'll find out. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the program where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange.
Well, now, don't you tell me to smile. You think I'm a-
the final minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. Coming up next hour, we call it the Dark 30 Hour. This is when we dig into some of the more outrageous and controversial news as of late. Not for the kiddies. Not for the easily offended. So stick around if you would like to be subjected to that kind of content late tonight. But now I'm finishing up my conversation with Nick Redfern, the prolific author, researcher, adventurer. And we've been talking about the new book that he contributed to called Hounds of the Baskervilles, From Demon Dogs to Sherlock Holmes, The True Story of the Beast. And, of course, we'll have links where you can find that book easily at speakingofstrange.com. And Nick's website is nickredfern.com. So, Nick, given that, you know, again, synchronicity, probably somewhere out there somebody will hear this program, and then tomorrow they'll see one of these black dogs, one of these hellhounds. Maybe somebody saw one yesterday. What advice can you give that person based upon the experience you have?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say, Josh, is, you know, not for people to think, you know, they're going crazy, because we have reports of these from all around the world, you know, from Britain, mainland Europe, North America, Latin America. It's a cultural thing that clearly exists pretty much everywhere. So, you know, people aren't going crazy, don't think that. Now, according to a lot of the original legends, you know, to see one of these things was perceived as being a precursor to death. But, which sounds pretty ominous, but when we look into these stories, although that is the legend, actually tying specific deaths to the encounters with the black dogs has actually proven to be quite difficult, you know, which is a fortunate thing. You know, it's almost like it was perceived as a Grim Reaper, but, you know, actually determining that somebody did die in the days afterwards or whatever has been harder to actually prove. So that's like a good thing, you know, that maybe that part of the story grew more out of the myth, you know, of real encounters. And, of course, as I mentioned, you know, earlier in the show, there are a lot of reports where the black dogs have also been helpful. You know, the cases where people have got lost on the moors in the, you know, foggy parts of England, and one of these black dogs will come along and tug them by the sleeve and then take them to the edge of the road, and then it vanishes, you know. So there's nothing malevolent about that aspect. But I think, maybe like a lot of paranormal phenomena, perhaps the phenomena responds, reacts, and even manifests to the perception of the witness. You know, it's almost like what you get for, what you ask for is what you receive. You know, so I think possibly, you know, the dog itself, whatever its purpose is, that it kind of reflects the inner fears of or perceptions of the person. And that's why, you know, there are so many different experiences. But I would just say try not to panic. Try and remain calm, try not to be hostile, and then hopefully, you know, it'll be of a less traumatic nature and, you know, just some spectral encounter rather than anything, you know, long-lasting and traumatic.
I've always been fascinated how one of the earliest encounters, I think it was at the church at Bungay in the late 1500s, mm-hmm. You know, it was a thundery lightning storm day, and these creatures appeared in the church. They tore people to bits, and then they ran out of the church and then appeared at another church mm-hmm. a few miles away. The connection between churches and thunderstorms and the spirituality, it's very symbolic and creepy on so many levels. But I guess
it is, and that's what makes these stories so fascinating. Is, yeah. You know, they don't just begin and end with the sighting of a black dog. You know, you have the locations. You have the byproducts of the, you know, the omens, etc. You have the animals vanishing. You have the association with certain specific areas, you know.
Yeah, who knows what it all really means, but it's fascinating. And maybe if somebody does see one tomorrow, they will have a camera handy because, hey, we all have cell phones and most of them have cameras nowadays.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Nick, I am one of your biggest fans, and I hope everybody reads this. And, gosh, anytime you've got something new coming out, keep us updated on it. And I've even heard through the grapevine that you and I might be working together again soon on another TV project. So.
Oh, good. I wish they'd told me that.
I'll give you a call sometime and tell you what's up.
All right, cool.
All right, Nick, thanks so much for being on the program, and hey, keep up the good work, my friend.
You too, Josh. Thanks a lot. Good night.
Right. Good night. There you have it, my friends. Nick Redfern, his website again, nickredfern.com. The book is called Hounds of the Baskervilles, From Demon Dogs to Sherlock Holmes, The True Story of the Beast. It is a publication of Timothy Green Beckley, Mr. UFO, Interlight Global Communications. And one thing I like about the way Tim publishes books is he is fond of going back and finding sort of older classic manuscripts and republishing them, but then adding a great deal of supplementary material in that digs even deeper from the modern perspective. And that's what we need, to go back and re-examine some of these phenomena from the sort of scientific, technological point of view that we have nowadays. When we come back, well, we've taken you to somewhat the summit of mankind's enlightenment. Now we're going to dig into the pit of his depravity as we look at the dark side of society in the dark 30 hour. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the program where the unusual becomes usual. Speaking of strange, we'll be back right after this.